Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. Hey everyone, I'm Simon Applebaum, simulcasting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker, and present on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. This just in, it's the Friday before Christmas, and tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Audible.com, proud development partner of the annual New York Television Festival, and the leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. And this holiday season, you can get 3 audiobooks for the trial of 1 at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later in the program. Good to have you with us on this Friday before Christmas 2018 on the program All About Television. 58 degrees is off the hour. Yes, it is raining, not just here, but up and down the East Coast and the South, all over the place, east of the Mississippi. We are awaiting a call live from London from James Strong. He is the award-winning director of the new Amazon adaptation of Vanity Fair that started its run on smart TV sets and smart TV devices earlier today. And as soon as we get James on, we will bring him to you for what will be a very short interview. He's dealing with a couple things at the moment, but he did agree to join us for a few minutes, and we hope to have him on ASAP. And James, if you hear us, give us a call, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. That number's good anyway. You're catching us across the country or around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio and Speaker. We have our chat room going for you. It'll be going for you in a big way today because we have a 90-minute show for you. And that way you can get involved by chat room is SimonApple04, and you'll find our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And while the program is on the air, you connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk screen. Follow the instructions, and other people can be live with you. Again, we're awaiting James Strong, the BAFTA, that's the British version of the Emmy-winning director of such shows as Broadchurch, and currently he is directing Vanity Fair. It is the latest adaptation of a book, a classic novel by William Thackeray that over the decades has been translated to films and TV programs all over the place. I still remember, I believe, it was one of the original Masterpiece Theater productions. It was also done for Masterpiece Junior when that was on a number of years ago on public television. And the current edition of Vanity Fair, which stars Olivia Cooke in the title role of Becky Sharp, that is now playing on smart TV sets and smart TV devices through Amazon Prime Video. So as soon as we get James, we'll have him on for a few minutes. Later in the program, this half hour specifically, we'll be joined by two of the key people who make Engadget one of the top technology news websites. We've got Engadget Dana Wallman and reviews editor Cheryl Lynn Lowe. We'll find out from them what they thought about TV technology this year. We'll preview CES, the big consumer electronics show, coming up in 2 weeks in Las Vegas. And we'll get their thoughts about TV technology will evolve this coming year with smart TV sets, smart TV devices, artificial intelligence, ATSC 3.0, interactive services, and a whole lot more. And then, at the top of the hour, we'll be joined by Dream Hampton, the executive producer of what will be Lifetime's first big blockbuster event of 2019, the 3-night miniseries Surviving R. Kelly. She will join us live at the top of the hour. So once again, James, and right now, joining us live from London, in an interview exclusive, the award-winning director of Vanity Fair on Amazon, which started today, James Strong. James, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. Greetings from London. It's a bit cold, but very Christmassy, which is perfect for Vanity Fair, which is always to be a very a period delight, a very festive story, and full of kind of Christmas. Well, it's a bit of Christmas, but very British, which feels kind of perfect for Amazon for, you know, for Christmas viewers over the Christmas period. So thank you, very very glad to join you.
And the same here, and a very happy holiday season from all of us to all of you with Blog Talk Radio and Speaker, James. Why is this novel by William Thackeray such a popular adaptation for television over the decades, and why did you decide to take it on?
Well, I decided to take it on because it was one of my favorite novels. I read it at university, and it's a classic. It's one of the you know, English literature's finest books. So it's like a kind of Shakespeare, as in every, you know, it's a text that you can do over and over. But you've got to find a new way to do it. And I think, you know, what appealed to me was two strong, young female characters at the heart of the drama. And to really kind of lean into that and to bring that to the screen, a story that was, you know, so pertinent and so relevant for a modern audience, the story of Becky Sharp, who spends her life trying to climb the social ladder and to try and better herself, and dreams of becoming rich and famous, and kind of is at the heart of that hunt and that search, you know, worth what all the sacrifice that she goes through. So it felt very relevant, this kind of story of a young girl doing everything she can to survive, but also then to climb the social ladder and to better herself. It felt very, very, very relevant to have a kind of strong female story at the heart of our drama.
Mm-hmm. The reviews I've seen so far that have been published in the last couple of days all over the place have two things in common. Number one, they believe that you and your crew have done a very good job in being faithful to the Thackeray novel. And secondly, that Olivia Cooke shines in the role of Becky Sharp.
Yeah, I think, we've had some great reviews, and so that's, you know, it's been wonderful to see it so well received over in America. Olivia Cooke is one of the finest screen actors of her generation, and is, you know, she's so young, but she's so brilliant, and she's done so much, and she was, I think, the best Becky Sharp ever. I mean, she's exactly the right age, and her background, and her kind of training, and brought this immediate authenticity to the role, and allowed her to develop and show all that she could do, you know, as the series develops, and she kind of is this chameleon, and she works her way up through society. She was just a completely delightful person to work for, a very, very talented actor, and she did an amazing job at, you know, what is a very difficult role, because Becky Sharp is very unlikable. You know, she does a lot of things which, you know, that Thackeray says this is a story with no heroines and no heroes in it. There's no good people. It's kind of very complicated. There's goodies and baddies, but it's all, you know, it's very real. So at the heart of it, Becky Sharp is somebody who's not immediately likable. So that's a kind of challenge for an actress to kind of keep the audience on side and keep rooting for her. But you do, even when she does seemingly terrible things, you kind of understand why she did it. And I think that's the trick of the actor and the cast to make sure they convey those complexities. And you know, I think Olivia did an amazing job.
You said a moment ago, James, that you wanted to make the character and the story relevant. How do you do that for a contemporary audience that is about to mark the end of one year and turn the corner into another?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, we had to strike a balance between making an adaptation that wasn't – I didn't want it to be modern and tricksy for the sake of it. So we had to kind of – be authentic, and so it's period correct in terms of the costume, in terms of the sets, in terms of the language. So we wanted that authenticity, but also it's going to be watched by a modern audience. So, you know, the way we shot it, I shot it like a contemporary drama. So I made no kind of reference to the fact that it was period. So it's very fast. There's lots of, you know, dynamic camera moves. It's got an editing pace to it. The music, although it's classical in style, it's a very modern neoclassical score. So everything should feel relevant and contemporary for a modern audience. And also we played around with the rules. She breaks the fourth wall, she looks at camera, it's cheeky, it's got, you know, we have contemporary songs at the beginning and the end of it. So we didn't want to make it a completely a completely modern show in the sense that people who know the book wouldn't enjoy it, but we wanted it to be feel relevant around the edges and just that kind of clever, hopefully fun, exciting kind of portrayal and expression of it, which would be, you know, something that which a modern audience could enjoy as well as all the other stuff that they've got to watch.
I know that we don't have much time left, but I did want to ask you what is on your agenda for directing television next year?
Well, we're coming into pilot season, so, you know, I'm going to be over in wonderful LA in January, kind of seeing what's around for pilots for next year. There's also Liar 2, which is the series I did for AMC and Sundance, which is coming back. So I'm going to be kicking off the first two episodes of that probably. And then there's lots of things around. You know, there's lots of great, this is the golden era of television. So there's so much amazing stuff that I'm spoilt, you know, and so I don't know exactly what I'm doing next, but it's, I'm really hoping it's going to be something, well, I know it'll be something amazing. I'm looking forward to 2019, and I hope all your listeners are too.
What is the fact that we have this era of plentiful TV where you have all these scripted shows from all over the place, from Amazon, from Netflix, from Hulu, broadcast TV, cable TV, et cetera. As a director, do you feel like, you know, kid in the candy store, you've got so many different ways you can play television, there's so many different avenues that you can express yourself?
Well, there are. I mean, in a way, there's so many platforms that there's so much choice and everybody wants content. I think the challenge is always finding the good material and the great material. And there's so many platforms also, there's so much choice for the viewer. You want to make sure that your show doesn't get lost. And I think that's the big challenge. But even there's some great, great shows that you just wonder, people just haven't got round to seeing them because there's just so much quality and so much quantity there that I think, you know, although we've got all this amazing, amazing stuff, you know, it's finding the shows which you feel can break through and that will find an audience, as well as being kind of interesting and an exciting project. So it's a great period. There's so much material now. You know, you kind of see some good shows that come and go, and you know, people kind of miss and stuff. I think it's really exciting. But as a director, you've got to be a bit more careful, you know, to make sure that you don't do something, because it's a long job. You know, you can Vanity Fair was a year for me, so you want to be picking stuff that you enjoy but also you know is going to find an audience.
Olivia Cooke is Becky Sharp in the new version of Vanity Fair, which came out today on Amazon. And if you have a smart TV set or a smart TV device like Amazon Fire TV, chances are you can get this miniseries right now. All you got to do is go to your smart TV set or device near you and pick it up. And for more details about the program online, here's where you go, www.amazon.com or www.amazon.com/originals. Vanity Fair, Lily Cook in the role of Becky Sharp, now available on a smart TV set or device near you. James Strong, the director of Vanity Fair, thank you for taking the time and joining us today. From all of us, all of you and your crew and cast, a wonderful Christmas holiday and a great start to your new year. And we'd love to have you back anytime you like.
Oh, that's great. I will definitely be back with whatever I'm doing next. Thank you so much to everybody. Have a wonderful Christmas from everybody here in London. We love you all, and we'll see you all very soon. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, James. Take care. All the greatest.
All right, man. Take care. Bye.
James Strong, director of Vanity Fair, joining us live from London, right here on Smart We Televise, which is brought to you by Audible.com. 58 degrees at the top of the hour, and if you would like to be involved in the program, all you got to do is give us a call, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number's been anywhere catching us across the country, around the world, here on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker. You can also get involved in our chat room. It's waiting for you. Time and Apple 04 by name. You'll find it on our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televise. And while the program is on the air, you can connect us by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk screen. Follow the instructions. Other people can be live with you. Coming up in the next half hour, a double show to know, a CBS special tonight marking a milestone, and you might say a classic Route 66 canine style, now available on YouTube. We'll get to that, and we'll get to our duo from Engadget about TV technology now and in the future. That's all coming up, but first of all, from the fine folks at Audible.com. One more time this holiday season, you have the opportunity right now to get 3 audiobooks for the trial of one. And all you got to do is go to audibletrial.com/televise. Audible.com is the leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment and information, inspiration too. There's over 180,000 titles to choose from, including a growing number of titles from the catalog known as Audible Originals. It's original audio programming, everything from original material to off-Broadway and Broadway shows to one-woman and one-man performances. And the great thing is that through this special holiday offer, you not only get one free audio book, but 2 Audible Originals titles. But remember, you already get to go by going to audibletrial.com/televise. By the way, you can listen to all these titles on any device, including whatever you're hearing us on right now at Blog Talk Radio and Speaker or at Radio. What you're going to do to get the 3 audiobooks, 2 Audible Originals, and 1 for the rest of the great catalog, any title you like, go to audibletrial.com/televise. And remember, you don't have that much longer to go. Holiday season's coming by and coming to an end quick. But don't forget, when you do subscribe, you get a 1-month trial, you get those 3 audiobooks to check out, and you get great customer service from the fine folks at Audible.com, which is, of course, part of Amazon.com. So remember, get 3 for the trial of 1 at audibletrial.com/televise. We will be checking in from New York with two of the key people at Engadget, the popular technology news website. We're talking about managing editor Dana Waltman and reviews editor Cheryl Lynn Lowe near the bottom of the hour. But first, time for a show to know. It's our regular feature where we highlight shows that are worth watching, and you might not know about them because they're not well marketed, promoted, publicized, fall on the radar screen of journalists and critics. And because it's the holiday season, we wanted to give you not one, but two shows to know this afternoon. And the first one is a CBS special that's been around for 20 years and is marking that 20th anniversary tonight. It's called The Home for the Holidays. And it's a show that is more than just being about Christmas. It's about the ongoing process of families whose lives have been changed through adoption and foster care. It's a collection of stories every year that will warm your heart, maybe sometimes break your heart, but certainly will move and inspire you. And it's a program that has great celebrities, and over the course of 20 years, it's really made a difference in the lives of literally hundreds of families around the country, and in some cases, in other corners of the world. And on this particular edition, it will showcase some of the great stories that have taken place on previous editions, including a story taking place in Elkhorn, Wisconsin, back in 2009, involving the Farnakis family, and the story of Philippe and Raphael Masquette out of Marathon, Wisconsin, that was featured in 2002. Plus, there's a new story you will be able to see just made for this particular edition. It deals with a family in Syracuse, New York, known as Perucci's, and how they got involved in the foster care system. The specials are done every year with the cooperation of the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption and the Children's Action Network. And by the way, you should know that right now, as we get ready to celebrate Christmas and Kwanzaa and other holidays this season, there are more than 438,000 children that are awaiting adoption or in foster care somewhere in these United States. So there's also a special section called Children Waiting, where you'll see some of those kids tonight. And maybe, just maybe, you and your family can give them a home for the holidays and beyond. It's a wonderful special. It's really well done. By the way, this year among the stars are Gwen Stefani, Train, Lucas Graham, plus a special tree lighting ceremony and a performance by Andy Grammer as well. That's the Home for the Holidays 20th Anniversary Special tonight on CBS, and it takes place at 8 p.m. Eastern at Pacific Time. Great special for the whole family. And if you want more details about the program, go to cbs.com. You can also go to the websites of both the Dave Thomas Foundation and the Children's Action Network. Once again, Home for the Holidays, 20th Anniversary Edition, tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern Pacific, on CBS. For more details, cbs.com. Our second show to know has just been made available on YouTube, and you might call it the Route 66 Canine Edition. Remember Route 66? You know, about two people that were searching for what life was all about in various corners of the United States, ran four seasons on CBS, made those episodes now on YouTube. Well, in the late 70s and early 80s, there was a Route 66 kind of program featuring a dog. It was called The Littlest Hobo. And if the title sounds familiar, well, there was an earlier series on film that took place in the early 1960s. It was done by Doyle McGowan, the man that put Death Valley Days on the air back in the 50s. It became one of the longest-running syndicated shows and the longest-running syndicated Western series in television history. Littlest Hobo was about a dog who roamed the countryside in search of something. And it was an ongoing story. But in this version, which is taped and shot in color, it's all about this dog played by London, really remarkable dog, who gets involved in all sorts of people's lives every episode, and at the end goes off on his merry way. Now, the great thing about this show is it really adopts the Route 66 formula, where you can have any kind of story you want playing with the dog. You can have anything from a straight family drama to a relationship situation, to a romance, to a spoof of a certain type of television show. There's one episode I saw recently on YouTube that is a secret agent, private eye kind of satire, to an espionage drama. And that's the fun thing about the show, is that it's done in such a way that the whole family can enjoy it, no violence in terms of on camera. It's really, really well done, and the dog is great, whoever plays London. The show ran for six seasons, I believe from 1978 to 1984 in Canada, and for a while it was also syndicated to TV stations around these United States. And like I said, you'll see many of these episodes now on YouTube at YouTube.com. YouTube, by the way, is available in many areas on smart TV sets and smart TV devices. The Littlest Fobo. Check it out. I think you'll really enjoy this show. And if you've never seen it, I think you're really in for a very big treat. And if you want more details, YouTube.com. Before we bring our guest from Engadget on, for those of you who missed our show on Wednesday, special Wednesday, this is the third three episodes we're doing, we did have a winner to our classic trivia question this week. The winner is Jim Sisui from Laguna Hills, California. Our question was this. On what TV series did Art Carney play Santa Claus? The winning answer is The Night of the Meek from The Twilight Zone. It was actually done nearly 60 years ago. It premiered on December 23rd, 1960, the night before Christmas Eve. And the show was actually taped 3 weeks before Christmas. It's a wonderful program, Night of the Meek on The Twilight Zone. Again, congratulations to Jim Sui of Laguna Hills, California. Congratulations, by the way, to all of our winners this year in our trivia contest. Jim, your prize is going to go out from here over the weekend. So I'll hopefully get to you next week. And we'll have our next classic trivia question on our first Monday edition of 2019 on January 7th. So once again, congrats to Jim. Congrats to all of our trivia winners. Thank you for participating. And everybody else, get in there and play into win starting on January 7th. But one more thing about the show to know. If there is a show to know that you think deserves support, please let us know, and if we use your suggestion on the air, you will get the credit. So remember, you got to let us know. So email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. That's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Don't forget to enclose your name and where you're emailing from, and if you're first with the correct answer, you will win. And now joining me here in New York to talk TV tech, where it's at, where it's going, we have the managing editor of the popular technology news website and gadget, Dana Wallman, and the reviews editor, Sherilyn Lowe. Dana and Sherilyn, happy holidays. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there.
Hello. Which one is this? Dana or Cheryl? Which one is this?
This is Dana, the editor-in-chief of Engadget.
Absolutely. Dana, great to have you, and Cheryl's going to join us shortly. So, Dana, we'll start with you. In your mind, what was the biggest technology story that impacted television this year?
I'm sorry, the biggest technology story having to do with television?
Yeah.
I would say the rise of artificial intelligence in televisions, and I think we need to be careful about how we define that. Because I think for some people that is going to be shorthand for just the rise of televisions that have built-in voice assistants, whether that's Alexa or Google Assistant. The key there is going to be natural voice control, just because. Oh, that's so funny. I have a speaker in my own house. That's so funny. So it's going to have one of these speakers, and I think the key is going to be how well they respond to natural voice commands, just because no one wants to be using a remote to input commands. And also just, I think sometimes with TVs, people don't even know what they're looking for, per se. So I think the discovery process will be improved by having these voice assistants built in. And then the other use for artificial intelligence isn't these speakers at all, but it's automatically tuning technology that helps people sort of bypass the need to even be in potentially complicated settings menus. So that's been on the rise this year, but it's something we expect to see a lot more of at CES this year.
Some people think, and in fact some companies may be betting, that because more and more smart television sets and smart TV devices, Dana, have artificial intelligence, have Google Assistant, have Siri, have Alexa, or Bixby, in the case of Samsung, Cortina from Microsoft, where you can talk back to the television set with your voice as opposed to remote, that may be the trigger to launching what people have been looking for decades, the era of artificial, the era of interactive television, of interactive retailing, of interactive advertising, where you can control which way the program goes or which way the advertising goes or be able to order products and services on the spot. And I'm hearing things all over the map, everyone from, yes, this is the trigger, we're going to see a major move next year, or we're more there than we had before, but we still have a way to go, or, you know, nothing else. Where do you see it being?
I'm sorry, where do I see what going?
Artificial intelligence and the television. Do you think we're going to see an era of interactive television kick off next year?
Yes, I do. And I think for starters, it's going to take the form of, when we say artificially intelligent televisions, I think for starters, it's going to be things like adjusting the picture settings, which a lot of people, at least maybe not Engadget readers, because Engadget readers are savvy, but the layperson might have trouble doing themselves, or at least might have trouble doing it well. So I think in the beginning, at least, AI is going to help optimize the picture and the sound quality without people having to dig in. And to that extent, to the extent that the out-of-the-box picture quality has already been quite good, I think AI is a bit of a marketing term. But there's still room, of course, for the functionality of that built-in intelligence to grow with future generations.
And the reviews editor of Engadget, Sherilyn Lowe, is joining us. Hi, Sherilyn.
Hey, Simon. How are you?
Very well, thank you. We just had Dana talk about artificial intelligence built into the television set. You've had a chance, I think, to review some of these. What do you think about these artificial intelligence voice features in TVs, whether it's Google Assistant or Siri or Alexa?
Yeah, so these are more like digital assistants that use artificial intelligence in a different way than Dana just explained, right? So it basically makes life easier for people who want to be a bit more of a couch potato. So you can either use the remote control physically to activate the voice assistant and ask it to look for your favorite TV show and all the different ecosystems like Apple TV, Fire TV by Amazon, and in some cases Android TV as well, are smart enough now to look through all your different service providers like Netflix, Hulu, or even your TV channels and find the program you're looking for. So you don't have to go think of, say, I want to watch Friends. Should I go to Netflix or should I go to ABC? And you can just ask the assistant to do that for you. And I think that that convenience is beneficial to most users. So far, though, we haven't seen that much else in terms of assistants on TVs. I think it's going to spread to more devices from more different brands. Right now we're seeing them to a smaller group of brands, but it should become more accessible even this year.
Keep in mind, too, that in every other context in our lives, these assistants are really skilled at learning our patterns and behaviors and, to some extent, maybe even know more about our routines than we do consciously. So, for instance, my phone, it knows that if I plug in headphones, I'm listening to Spotify and not Apple Podcasts for whatever reason. But on the TV, I think these assistants can learn a lot over time about what our preferences are in terms of content, what shows and movies we're looking for. And I think every device maker, every content provider wants to be better at that. I'm sure that Netflix's discovery algorithm is a really closely kept secret. So any way that these machines and these services can better understand our routines and our preferences, that's gold for them.
So then how sophisticated in this coming year are these voice features going to get? Will they allow us as watchers to order products on products and services while a show is on, to order merchandise, to get involved with an Airbnb or order a Lyft ride or a ticket through Ticketmaster or StubHub to an event? I'm just curious how you see the sophistication level, the language level of these services going.
So I don't think they're going to come to our TVs this year, but I do think it's in the pipe. Like, it's probably going to happen soon if that's a feature that companies want to integrate. And I don't see why not, because you're already able to order stuff off of Amazon by talking to its assistant. And it's more than just working this into the TVs. It's more than just implementing your assistant into a TV. It's also just making sure that the ads or the creators of ads have enabled that interactivity too. So I think there's just a bit more of a ways to go before that is a feature that is live. And I'm also not sure what are the behind-the-scenes discussions people are having on this, where they're all, I wouldn't be surprised if they were, because it seems like an obvious way to make money. I don't want to have that feature myself, just because it seems too easy for me
either.
To waste a lot of money.
I think you're right. I wouldn't be so surprised if I saw those features, but I also don't know how if that's the smartest move. I think for some of these companies, it's going to be kind of a long game, where the name of the game is to really lock people into an ecosystem early and really deeply, you know, with the TV, but also maybe a sound bar that hooks into the same ecosystem and maybe a whole smart home full of compatible products and mm-hmm. all of which are learning about your preferences and your behavior. I don't know if selling people things right away is the smartest move, just in the sense that there is a risk that it could put people off.
Mm-hmm.
We are coming to the bottom of the hour, and when we get back, we'll have more about where things are going in the world of TV technology and how content may be impacted by it with Dana Wollman and Sherilyn Lowe from Engadget. And coming up at the top of the hour, we will have Dream Hampton, the executive producer of what looks like Lifetime's first big blockbuster miniseries of 2019, Surviving R. Kelly. All of that after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. You listen to the best internet radio on the planet, www.blogtalkradio.com and www.spreaker.com. Together, reaching over 30 million listeners around the world every month and growing. On Blog Talk Radio, it's your home for The Stew. Check out Wednesdays, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, exclusively on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, that's BTR available 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to Marvy Televised, 90-minute edition before your Christmas holiday weekend. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York on Blog Talk Radio and Speaker. We're also on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network, 58 degrees at the top of the hour. Yes, the rain is happening, but it is supposed to taper off tonight in time for the beginning for a lot of people of the Christmas holiday weekend. And hope that's the case, whether you're up and down the East Coast or east of the Mississippi. And joining us right now this half hour, continuing our conversation here in New York, is Dana Wollman, the managing editor of Engadget, the popular technology news website, and reviews editor Sherilyn Lowe. Dana, one thing I've been hearing, saying for a moment on the subject of interactive television, is that Netflix and Apple and other people are going to go all in next year with doing interactive or choose-your-own-direction programming. At an event last week here in New York, I heard from someone to know that Netflix has actually hired a programming person to directly do this. It's not just going to be an episode of Black Mirror here or Stranger Things there. It's going to be actual original shows with this. There was a CNBC report 2 weeks ago that Apple is telling its producers, make shows immersive, make them interactive. What are you hearing out there about this idea of interactive content starting to happen in a big way next year?
It's interesting. I mean, it reminds me a little bit around some of the buzz that we've heard around VR programming, just this idea that you are in control of your environment and to some extent that you're, because you can, let's say in VR, you could control where you look. You have some control over what happens next and what kind of content you're exposed to. So it's interesting to hear word that TV makers, or not TV makers, but content makers, producers, for more two-dimensional formats might be thinking along similar lines. They're not two mediums that you think of being similar. This wouldn't be the first time we heard about some kind of content where the viewer had control over what they were seeing.
So, go ahead.
I don't know
if you're referring to the reports earlier about Netflix possibly launching choose-your-own-adventure options for things like Black Mirror. But that's something we've heard about for a while now. And to Dana's point, it is very intriguing. I personally, when I put on the Netflix series, I just want to sit back and relax. I don't want to be choosing my own adventure. And so I don't know, like, how the audience is going to take to it. It does seem more like a gaming, a more personal and a personalized experience for the viewer, because then, you know, what are you going to talk about at the water cooler? Are you going to talk about the different outcomes that resulted from what you chose? Or are you going to talk about everybody, you know, who experienced the same storyline being able to talk about that? I think there is value in doing the choose your own adventure thing, and I'm not surprised that Apple might actually be looking at it seriously too, because they do need to catch up with Netflix in terms of their original content programming. I am skeptical about how it'll work, but you know, Netflix will do what Netflix does, and it'll probably find its own audience.
We have seen, and this is not new, but there have been times when there's been an alternate ending filmed for a movie or a TV show. So that wouldn't be unusual, and that would be kind of some nice bonus content to see it play out a totally different way. I do think if it were anything as simple as that, it would be a little disingenuous to call it choose your own adventure, when really you're just getting sort of pre-filmed bonus content. But, yeah, it'll be interesting to see to what extent content producers really roll with that.
Incidentally, if you'd like to talk with our folks, Dana and Sherilyn from The Gadget, all you have to do is give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. You'll find it at the homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Sherilyn, before we move on, one thing about interactive television. We know there are two websites out there that already do interactive programming. One is Echo, E-K-O, that was put together by Samsung, that was put together by MGM, which has some of the programming and some venture capitalists. And now Walmart has made a $250 million investment into that service. And we also have Alpha from Legendary, the folks behind Lost in Space on Netflix, Pacific Rim, other movies that have been blockbusters. And they did a live science fiction series this fall called Over the Redux, where you could use whatever to influence the characters and the plot line. I don't know if you've seen either of those two, Sherilyn, but if you have, I wonder if you think either of them are going to become interactive television next year.
I haven't really experienced either of them myself. I did see a bunch of interactive choose-your-own-adventure type things at Tribeca Film Festival last year and even this year as well. Again, I think that it takes a lot of thinking about how to present this format to people. I'm not familiar enough with either of these services to know if these are going to take off as a TV format in the coming year. Again, I wouldn't be surprised, though, if people, you know, like it for a very specific reason because it creates such a personalized experience. But, yeah, like it's pretty new. It hasn't really, in my opinion, taken off just yet. So.
And I think even though services like Netflix and Amazon are huge and are sort of forcing other big players like HBO to change the way they think about movies and TV, I think a Netflix or an Amazon in some ways is still in the spaghetti throwing phase where they, what we're seeing from them is not so much experimental interactive pieces, but a lot of more traditional TV and movies, a lot of it coming out, some of it highbrow, some of it lowbrow, and it seems that the companies are still trying to figure out what people want and what will be a success. And because they are so cash rich and so have so many resources, they really can't afford to play that spaghetti throwing game possibly more than, you know, another company or another startup would.
Yeah. Dana, this was the year that smart TV sets and smart TV devices, and I'm talking about Roku, Amazon Fire, Apple TV, Google Chromecast, et cetera, reach critical mass with the American public. Depending on who you learn from, it's anywhere from 2/3 to 3/4 of all U.S. TV households now have them. And we know that the usage level is skyrocketing. Nielsen reported a couple weeks ago, in September alone, people with smart TV sets and devices saw 8 billion hours of content and applications for that month. That's huge. Do you think this is what is driving television, all of TV? And where do you see this going in 2019?
I don't know if it's what's driving television. I mean, I do think that you're right that smart TVs have taken off. They've gone from being this fancy sort of high-end feature to becoming more or less standard to the point where it's easy to imagine a future when plug-in media streaming sticks or set-top boxes one day become sort of a thing of the past, sort of obsolete. So you're right, they've become more common, and I think it's been interesting to just see the price come down. Now, I don't know if that's the number one feature people are looking for when they're shopping. I think it's also equally important that the price of 4K sets has come way down. You can go into a place like Costco now or Best Buy and get a 4K set for really not that much money. And I think that has played just as much of a role in driving people's usage as the fact that they feature smart TV platforms. And it's the timing's interesting, right? I mean, we're at a time when 8K TVs are about to ship. Most people won't be able to afford them, and sort of 4K and these smart TVs are the new table stakes, really.
So I wanted to add on a little bit, sorry, to what Dana was saying. You know, I don't think that particularly smart TVs are going to drive TV consumption. I think what you're seeing smart TVs change is the way that you know, content producers and studios are buying and ordering content too, because this we've seen this in the past few years. Now we have Netflix rise as a huge power, and they're able to order seasons of things that otherwise would have been left behind by the traditional studios that, you know, don't see maybe the long-term future, but now you're able to buy like a one-off season or something, and that will still do really, really well. I think that's what's driving TV production and even consumption more than before, and that's where the smart TV part comes in, because it makes it so much easier to get those services on your TV set.
And Sharon, how smarter are these sets and devices going to be next year? Are you getting any advance word, because we have CES coming in Las Vegas in 2 weeks? Are you getting any sense of how smarter these devices will be? Because already, for example, if you have Apple TV or Amazon Fire TV in any iteration, whether it's an operating system, the TV set, or it's a streaming stick, whatever, you can order any Amazon merchandise product you want. If you have Apple TV, you already have the opportunity to work with Airbnb, order tickets from StubHub, get pizza from Papa John's, maybe get some help from Home Advisor. I mean, and in some cases, you might be able to do other things with your home, like turn on your lights, work with your air conditioning, work your microwave oven, connect with your garage door opener. How smarter are these sets and devices going to be?
Yeah, I think you're talking about the general trend of assistants getting smarter, and the fact that they're much more fully integrated into TV sets now is what's driving this perception that they're actually getting smarter. In the past, smart TVs look more almost quaint, right, with their really old-fashioned operating system or interface, and now they're just really, sort of a interface, and then we have the assistant features built in, and that's where it's really smart. It depends on what each assistant can do. So it will obviously get smarter as these assistants learn to do more things around your home and your life, but we're also keen on seeing what AI is able to do with the technology. Dana mentioned earlier that, you know, it can help with picture settings. It can also help upsample certain content sources. It can help improve the quality of the video you're watching. There's a lot of things that are about to get smarter. I can't say as to what we may or may not know about CES.
I would keep an eye on Samsung just because it uses its own Bixby assistant, which has been known for being sort of behind the competition. It debuted later. It needed more work. And because it is proprietary, we're always a little more surprised at CES when we can see how Bixby has improved and what it's now able to do in Samsung devices. It's a little different from Alexa or Google Assistant, where it's built into so many devices that by the time CES rolls around, you've seen it and everything, you know all of their tricks already. But I think Samsung is one company to keep an eye on because they do have this proprietary system that needed work and will probably roll out at CES with some more improvements in store.
Mm-hmm. Dana, one of the interesting stories this fall has been the lack of information from the smart TV set makers and device makers themselves about what they are up to and what new features are out there. And it's everything from Apple not saying a thing about Apple TV at their event in Cupertino, California, and the event they had here in New York a few weeks ago from Academy Music. Samsung at the Barclays Center, nothing about smart sets except in the middle of the showcase Bixby. Amazon in Seattle, and Alexa met with didn't say anything about Amazon Fire, Google, nothing about Chromecast. Why are these smart TV set mega devices not saying a thing? What is don't they get any feedback from marketing PR saying, hey, you know, people are using your product. Don't you think you'll let them know what they can do?
I'm trying to understand your question. You mean why are they not better educating consumers on how the devices can be used?
Yes, why are they not being public? Why do you have a situation with Apple where, for example, at their events this fall, one in Cupertino, California, and the Brooklyn Academy Music, they have a lot to say about the iPhone, they have a lot to say about Apple Watch, and yet with millions of people using Apple TV, they can't say a thing. It just doesn't make sense. And wouldn't you, if you were Tim Cook, and you had 10,000 apps in your Apple TV, and you wanted, and I'm sure that they've done some new things over the last couple of months, why wouldn't you showcase them? It just comes off as a real big missing.
I actually think Apple does a better job educating consumers on these platforms than most other companies. I've been in the audience at Apple keynotes, and Apple does spend time on tvOS and Apple TV. To your point, it's usually a lot less time than iOS or Mac products. But Apple does give a lot of lip service to its TV platform and give demos of how it's meant to be used, which I think is an improvement over Amazon, let's say, and Amazon's Fire service. I don't personally find it the most intuitive to use, and there is just the sense that you buy the products because they're cheap and well-reviewed, and you kind of just figure it out on your own. If you can't figure it out, you call someone in your family who can help. But, yeah, I think Apple has done a better job than perhaps some other companies. And as far as these set makers who have these built-in smart TV interfaces, those have evolved over the years, but there's obviously no standard, and these are primarily hardware makers dabbling in user experience, which is a totally different beast.
By the way, guest 3349 has just joined our chat room. Simon Apple, Zero 4. My name is Welcome aboard. You have a question or comment for Dana Wolman, the managing editor and editor-in-chief of Engadget, and Sherilyn Lowe, the reviews editor there. Put it in the chat room or give us a call, 646-652-2906. Sherilyn, what are you looking forward to at CES in a couple of weeks when it comes to television?
When it comes to television, man, I was about to go crazy with the broader trends. When it comes to television, I'm looking forward to seeing 8K TV sets, like Dana mentioned, getting a bit more affordable, spreading throughout more companies that typically make more affordable devices for the consumer, say, for example, TCL or Hisense. The spread of the ecosystem, too.
Dana, is there anything technology under the radar screen that's going to get discussed at CES, for example, ATSC 3.0, and how broadcasters are going to try to keep themselves afloat in this era of more people watching Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, et cetera, et cetera?
Sure. Lynn and I were just talking about ATSC 3.0 before the show, and it's obviously promising. It, you know, has the promise of people receiving much higher quality broadcast video for free. But in the eyes of our editors, on our staff, it's kind of like 5G. It's this really talked-up, promising technology that just isn't there yet and isn't changing people's lives yet. So we'll be on the lookout to hear more about that at the show. But the thing about it is that so far, this new ATSC standard, it's been slowly evolving, and the development has been slow. So I wouldn't say our hopes are up too high in terms of how much we'll learn at this show in a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm. Sherilyn, there's also been some talk that the gaming community may finally be ready to put games on the television set. We're not just talking consoles like PlayStation or Atari, but actually put them on the television set. For example, you have NVIDIA Shield, you do have Android games that are powered that way. What are you hearing about that? Is that something we may see at CES, this idea of more sophisticated games on the television set?
I don't think that CES is necessarily the show for that sort of announcement. I feel like that might be something they save for E3, a more gaming-centric show, but that, again, that's not really something that I'm that aware of. I haven't really heard all that much about it, I mean, but it does seem like a natural evolution.
And it would be ironic when it happens. I mean, I remember the Ouya gaming set-top box, which promised just that, TV, you know, games on your TV, not necessarily console-grade games. And, you know, that business just, it went out of business. It was just sort of ahead of its time. It couldn't make the business model work. So if and when something like that reemerges, there'll be some irony there. And it'll be interesting to look back and compare it to this years ago technology that seemed kind of odd back then.
Mm-hmm. Dana, this coming year, we know there are going to be some new players in the world of TV programming that use smart TV sets and devices to get their services to the public. Apple, Walmart, whether with Echo or with original programming on Vudu, maybe Costco.
Don't even count out Facebook. I mean, even Facebook wants to get in on some original programming, and actually I met with them recently, and that was one of the top things they wanted to talk about of all their products. A lot of people.
Dana, let's talk about that. Before we get to Apple and Disney Plus and WarnerMedia and so forth, and maybe Comcast, let's talk about Facebook Watch. I'll tell you, I think this most underrated story of the year, and maybe the sleeper story of the year, is that Facebook, because of the scripted shows they've done, many of which we've had, the creators of all of them we've had in this program, that they are now getting 400 million views a month. It looks like they've turned the corner, and it looks like maybe Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, amid all the craziness that their company is going through right now, do you get a sense that they're going to put more money in and really use smart TV sets and devices to increase distribution?
I think there's a very good chance they'll put more money in, especially if they're a company that has very little to lose, or at least a very lot of cash to spend. But I think for Facebook, it's especially important because, you know, I don't think they're interested in being highbrow movie or TV producers, but I think they are very interested in keeping people on the platform, which has been a growing struggle for Facebook. They've had to deprioritize. They haven't had to deprioritize news, but they've chosen to deprioritize news in an effort to possibly keep people from seeing fake news. And they've been trying to amp up the number of personal posts that people see. But then Facebook has to wonder, if we're still growing, how do we keep people, more people staying on the platform, keep them from quitting, have them spend more hours a day on Facebook? Video is a bet for them. I don't know if it'll pay off, but it is one of their bets.
I will say that I personally spend a lot less time on Facebook now, but I did recently spend about an hour just watching an episode of Jada Pinkett Smith's Red Roundtable. That is a Facebook Watch show, I believe, and it was gripping. The production values were great. Content was good. I was surprised by the quality of that programming, actually.
And by the way, Sorry for Your Loss, which is the drama that was put together by Kit Steinmuller and Lizzie Weiss, both were on our program a few months ago. It has really taken off. It's on a number of 10 or 20 best mm-hmm. lists. Some are calling it one of the best new shows of the year. Some are calling it one of the best series year, period. And they're getting a lot of Facebook, and they've really formed a Facebook group in terms of people who have been dealing with the loss of a loved one, particularly either a wife or a husband, that have really taken that show to heart.
They have a lot of big names tied to some of their programming, too. I think Jennifer Aniston is working on a show with them, too. And that's something I would watch. I would sign back into Facebook to watch.
And also Paul Lee, the former head of ABC Entertainment, with his new project with Creative Arts Agency backing it, they did the show with Catherine Zeta-Jones, Queen America, and they've got two more shows at least, I think, coming for Facebook Watch. I think the fact that the first three shows are all on doing on that platform is really new something. As I mentioned, Dana, we're going to see maybe by this time next year, Apple, we're going to see more from Facebook Watch. We're going to see Walmart. We may see Costco, Disney Plus, Warner Media. Maybe if that Christmas card from Steve Burke at Comcast is a cryptic kind of thing, we're going to see Comcast get in. What do you make of this? All these new players that are going to get into the world of content through smart TVs?
I think after a point, if you're a big company with a lot to lose, you don't have much choice. I mean, Walmart, how are you going to continue competing with Amazon if you don't have some sort of equivalent to Prime TV? So it's, you know, I think the jury is out on which of these services will survive. I don't think they can all win over the same group of people. That would just be a really expensive bill for a cord cutter. But I think all these companies have to try. They can't just sit it out. And I think history shows what happens when big companies sit out major tech trends. You know, in other spaces, look at Microsoft sitting out mobile. That didn't work too well for them. Sorry for the background noise here.
And Sherilyn, let's talk Netflix for a bit. It looks like they are now making the transition from bringing their first generation of content shows, Orange is the New Black, House of Cards, the Marvel shows, to a close. But boy, they had some year this year with a whole bunch of second-generation, third-generation shows, and the way things are shaping up, you're going to have those exclusive deals with Shonda Rhimes and Kenya Barris and Ryan Murphy kick in, and now Channing Duguay just will be coming in February from ABC to work with Cindy Holland and Ted Sarandon crew to really maybe take things to a whole new level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that Netflix more than ever has to really amp up its quality of its original programming, right, because with Disney supposedly opening its own streaming service very soon, they're losing all the Marvel shows. But and the fact that they had such a great reaction on the internet when it sounded like Friends was going to go off of Netflix, You know, people are very attached to their Netflix programming, and Netflix really has to step it up. And they have had a great run this year. Like you said, the second generation and third generation slate of shows have done so well. They've won so many awards, and I think it's they're becoming a really good contender in terms of, you know, as a content creator and being a studio. They're something to be taken very seriously more than ever before. But they do have very stiff competition from Facebook and the likes of Hulu as well.
And by the way, if what we're hearing from Bob Iger, head of Disney, is true, when that Fox-Disney merger completes, Hulu is going to get a big infusion of money to do a lot more original shows to follow up on The Handmaid's Tale.
They should. That was a very good show.
Mm-hmm. Dana, I understand that early on at CES, where they have the media days, that Procter & Gamble, one of the biggest advertisers, one of the biggest consumer products makers, is going to have a press conference. Does anyone have an inkling about what they're going to do there? Are they looking to get back into content in a major way? Because don't forget, back in the, for the most part of this existence of television, they were the major creators of soap operas. At one point, they were doing made-for-TV movies. Does anybody have a sense of what Procter & Gamble is doing at CES and whether that might be a television situation?
I don't know. I mean, it's especially tough to know because Procter & Gamble is the custodian of so many different brands. But to the extent that it's really a consumer goods company with a lot of different household items, potential medical or health-related items, it's not a terrible surprise. Certainly separate from TVs, health is another health products are another big category that we've seen a lot more of over the past few years at CES. So not sure what their announcement might have to do with the entertainment space at all, but it wouldn't, you know, so many, they own so many brands and so many of which are now relevant to what was used to be this TV and just gadget show.
I think, Simon, if you look at the sorry to cut in, but if you look at the press release that was about the P&G ventures for CES, it has a lot to do with these health and consumer tech related things. It might, like Dana said, have to do with entertainment as well, but it, my gut feeling about this is that it has more to do with their, you know, healthcare section.
I think it's something, by the way, that the television side should look at with is interactive healthcare. I think there's a real opportunity for television to be involved in that field of interactive healthcare in some fashion. And we'll see if it and interactive banking also, and we'll see if that comes to great. Before we let you both go, Dana, is there a company that will be at CES that will be doing a TV project or trying to get one off the ground that we should be paying attention to?
So far we're focused on the usual suspects, but we'll have a closer look at the floor once the show starts. And I don't know if you know, Engadget is judging the official Best of CES Awards, and as usual we have a Best TV product. So by that point we will have done a more thorough scouring of the floor, including some of the smaller companies we might not have an eye on now. So anyway, I can't give you any spoilers, but so far we've been focused mainly on the usual suspects.
And, of course, CES will be taking place 2 weeks from now at the Las Vegas Convention Center and buildings nearby. You can always go to the Consumer Technology Association or CES's own website to check that all out. And, of course, Engadget will be covering it from wall to wall. And if you want more details about what Dana and Sherilyn and their gang do every day, go to www.engadget.com. It's a great website, great coverage, and I think you'll really enjoy the read now and throughout 2019. Dana Wallman, Sherilyn Lowe, managing editor and review editor of Engadget Respectively, thank you for taking the time to be with us. A very happy holiday season to you and your crew. Have a great time to see us. We'd love to do this again down the road in 2019. Let's make it sooner than later.
Thank you.
For sure. Thanks so much, Simon.
You're very welcome, Dana and Sherilyn. Take care. All the greatest.
Bye.
Edelman and Sharon Lowe joining us live from New York here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Coming up next week, we'll be with you both Wednesday and Friday. And on the day after Christmas, joining me as our lead guest will be Sophia Tikal. She is the co-writer director of the latest installment of Hulu's In the Dark series from Jason Blum and his Blumhouse gang. It's called New Year, New Year. If you think you've seen the every New Year's Eve or New Year's Day promo in sight, wait till you see this. It's very interesting. It was just seen, by the way, earlier this week at the main New York Media Center here in New York. And we'll also have the director of an upcoming Lifetime Movie Network film called The Wrong Teacher. His name is David DiCoteau. He's done a lot of these wrong films. We'll find out why. And about this latest one, which will be premiering next week on the Lifetime Movie Network. That's all coming up Wednesday, 3 p.m. New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. When we come back, joining us live, we will have Dream Hampton from Surviving R. Kelly coming to Lifetime starting January 3rd. But first, we pause at the top of the hour for web identification. www.blogtalkradioandspeaker.com, 130 million listeners around the world every month and growing. It's your home for Kings of the Morning. Check it out every weekday, including Monday at 11 a.m. Eastern, 8 a.m. Pacific, exclusively on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, best BTR 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to Tomorrow Will Be Televised on this Friday before Christmas 2018. Welcome to those of you just joining us at the top of the hour. Simon Appleton will be live from New York on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. If you have a question or comment for our next guest, give us a ring, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. Our next guest is the executive producer of a very important project, so important that Lifetime is making it its first blockbuster miniseries of 2019. It premieres on January 3rd at 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time. It's called Surviving R. Kelly. Joining us live is an interview exclusive executive producer, Dream Hampton. Dream, thank you for being here.
Hi, Simon. Thank you for having me.
It is a pleasure. You have been involved as a filmmaker in a lot of very interesting topics, and certainly this one has got to be at the top of the list. Why do this?
I just think it's so important. I think that Tarana Burke said it best when she talked about, she says this in the docuseries, that there was this moment where we started talking about Harvey Weinstein, you know, Roger Ailes. We started talking about a lot of powerful men in entertainment and their kind of decades of alleged abuses. And somehow R. Kelly got, you know, left out of that conversation. And he's someone that people like me, when I was in film school and college at NYU, I used to make my living as a music journalist. And so he's been on my radar forever as someone, you know, who is long past, you know, getting his comeuppance. And I just thought that it was important that these girls' stories be heard and centered. And so I was, you know, I can't say that I was, like, overjoyed when Lifetime, you know, contacted me about doing this project, but I knew that it was an important one. This has been a dark year. It hasn't been one of joy, but it's been one of great purpose.
Why do you feel that in the conversation about Me Too, Time's Up, and everybody from, particularly media, from Harvey Weinstein to Charlie Rose, to Matt Lauer, to Roger Ailes, and all the way down the line, that R. Kelly is not, you know, somebody in the shadows here. This is somebody who was on top of the world in the music industry. Why he has not gotten as much attention as other people in entertainment and media?
Well, first I want to, you know, give a huge hat tip to the work that Jim Deere Jim out of Chicago has done. First, you know, in local papers, Jim DeRogatis, and then later in BuzzFeed and other places. So he's been relentless. He has been writing about R. Kelly nonstop. But I think there are three reasons that R. Kelly's kind of escaped this moment, attention in this moment, until our docuseries, which obviously airs January 3rd, one of them is that he's not on top of the music industry anymore. He is a 50-plus R&B singer whose star has faded, who hasn't made important or relevant music in a long time. So I think that we, even if his behavior has kind of escalated, well, has absolutely escalated, where we have parents, three sets of parents, trying to get their daughters back from him, which is just, you know, a lot, and we deal with that in the docuseries. The second is that it's the music industry. So there is a history. Ann Powers, legendary music writer, used to be a columnist at Los Angeles Times, used to edit me when she was at Village, I think Spin, I can't remember, but she's at NPR now, and Ann Powers, great music journalist, you know, situates this in a long history of kind of rock stars sexualizing women in their lyrics, from Aerosmith to Little Richard, to real life kind of stories around, you know, rock stars being with younger girls, whether it's Elvis with 14-year-old Priscilla, or Jerry Lee Lewis marrying his 12-year-old cousin, or Jimmy Page, you know, 5-6 years ago being photographed out with his 18-year-old date, right? So there's this way that we've built up this tolerance to this kind of behavior when it comes to musicians. And then the third and most important reason that I think that we have turned away from this story is because the victims aren't the ones that we as a society historically have even acknowledged to be victims of sexual violence. And that's Black women. And that's for all kinds of complicated reasons. But first and foremost is that we are often not seen, you know, worthy of defense when it comes to these kinds of crimes.
This three-night event has more than 50 interviews in it.
Yeah.
For many of the people that you and your crew interviewed, what was the most common point that they wanted to make about what they went through?
That's a great question, Simon. And I must have done a good 35 of those interviews. When it came to his survivors, he's been doing this for a long time. For, you know, almost 30 years. Marriage to Aaliyah was, you know, almost 30 years ago when she was 15 and he, of course, was 28. And then lawsuits came out right after that happened. Tiffany Hawkins, he started settling lawsuits quickly with teenage girls. So we realized after Aaliyah that this wasn't some one-off, that he was actually a predator. But what was common throughout the interviews was that whether these women knew him in 1996, 2004, 2000, we have a girl that, you know, dated him in 2017 and publicly came out about having contracted an STD from him and being filmed by him without her consent and being abused by him. That was 2017. So we have these stories of girls, you know, kind of turning around in the bedroom and seeing that there is an iPad, camera, you know, that they're being filmed. The stories of abuse, the stories of control, being denied food, horrific things. And these women are from they're different ages. They are from different periods in his life. And they have the exact same story. They weren't brought in to be interviewed at the same time. Often they didn't know one another, although some of them have begun to kind of create de facto support groups where they are beginning to know each other now, and finding kind of comfort in realizing that their story, that they weren't the only one, that they weren't somehow deserving of this abuse, that this is his pattern. So that was the shocking thing, was that, you know, not the shocking thing, I mean, but it was the affirming thing and something that, quite frankly, legal at Buna Murray, who's the production partner, who are the people who hired me and brought me on, their legal department, just like A&E's and Lifetime's, they needed cooperation. We couldn't just run a bunch of stories that were wild that one person said. And so Bree Bryant, you know, from Lifetime, said, I want as many witnesses as possible, and she pushed us. We were like, we have 12, Bree, and Bree was like, get me 24. and we make the case in this story, I mean, in this docuseries, that these stories are to be believed and to be heard.
You are hearing Dream Hampton. She is the executive producer of Surviving R. Kelly. It is Lifetime's first blockbuster miniseries of 2019, and it takes place Thursday, January 3rd at 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time and runs probably for the second two nights after. Dream joins us live this half hour on Tomorrow We Televise. Simon Applebaum will be live from New York. Happy you're with us on this Friday before the Christmas holiday weekend, and we hope that you're getting ready to celebrate a marvelous Christmas or Kwanzaa, whatever holiday you celebrate with you and your loved ones. It is 58 degrees at the top of the hour. Yes, it's supposed to hit 60 or more before the day is out, and hit 50 plus tomorrow when all the rain is gone and moves away. If you have a question or comment for Dream, make the call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Our final episode of 2018 is a week from today, and we will focus on where blockchain and cryptocurrency are going to take television. We have Tony Perkins. He's the man that put the red herring on the map in the 1990s and 2000s, and now he has a new venture called Crypto Ventures, and we'll talk to him about that and where he sees television playing a role in blockchain and cryptocurrency. And also joining me will be, I think, the best columnist who covers the world of TV advertising. He's done it for the last 3 years with Media Village. Before that, the New York Times, Stuart Elliott. That's all coming up right here on Tomorrow We Televise next Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific. And by the way, on our episode next Wednesday, we'll also have our annual feature, Tomorrow We Televise Remembers, where we honor the people in front of and behind the TV camera who passed away this past year. That's Tomorrow We Televise Remembers on a 90-minute edition of our show, next Wednesday, December 26th, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker. Dream, once you got going, how willing were the subjects able to talk to you on camera? How willing were they?
Well, you know, it varied. Some were very willing. I mean, we have dozens of women who would not come on camera at all. And I should say not just women. We had all kinds of people. We had people who were involved in the court case, police officers. We had, you know, jurors from that court case, prosecutors. We had all kinds of people, his attorney, celebrities. We had so many people who were not willing to go on camera. So that's why I really talk about, and he had, in terms of women and what he's been doing with women all of this time, you know, this is decades of behavior. So he has literally hundreds of victims. And I'm really grateful for the more than, you know, dozen that did come up and speak to us. You know, some had been telling their stories. Some had been telling their stories in print. And it was a challenge to kind of get them out of what the story was and ask them new questions and get them to go even deeper. And some were really afraid and hadn't talked about this at all. And that was its own challenge. It required a particular kind of care. And, you know, I just learned a lot about being on the receiving end of this kind of trauma and also trying to deepen my practice as a listener.
Mm-hmm. How was that? What did you learn about all that listening you did and dealing with the fact that all this trauma was coming out from them at you?
Well, I don't want to center myself in this story. I mean, I'm going to do what I can to take care of myself, you know, this season, actually. I'm trying to unplug and just kind of cleanse spiritually from. But they're the ones who have to live with it and still do the healing. And you know, what was clear is that whether this had happened in the late 90s, as it had with Lisa Van Allen, who showed up to a video set with a girlfriend who wanted to be in the video at 16 and ended up, you know, being in this so-called relationship with R. Kelly for years, or someone who had just, like Faith Rogers, just, you know, gotten out of it a couple of months before she came on camera, they all were still dealing with very raw emotions. Like, there hadn't been that period of healing. And so I think that a lot of us have, particularly Americans, we have this idea of pushing through things. Work always comes first, you know. We just think that if we just do the work and power through it with whatever kind of trauma that we're dealing with, then it will somehow magically self-heal. And that just doesn't happen. We really do have to give our wounds the attention that they need to heal. And that means therapy. That means being in conversation with other survivors. That means all kinds of things for different survivors.
Is that why the program is called Surviving R. Kelly as opposed to, let's say, Overcoming R. Kelly or some other title?
For sure. These women are self-identified as survivors, not victims. I mean, you know, we have 6 episodes, 6 hours, but I could have done another 4 on where they are in their lives right now. In fact, we're collaborating with this racial justice, online racial justice organization, Color of Change, to kind of tell that story of what they're doing in their lives right now. It would be like an addendum viral piece. But, yeah, I mean, they in this piece, we definitely focus on what happened in their relationship with him and how systemic it is. But, you know, they are women who have survived him, who aren't just defined by having been victimized by him.
Just to cover the space, was there any effort to reach out to R. Kelly, his entourage, his lawyers, or any comment or get their side of things?
Of course, and some of his entourage came on camera. You know, we have someone who was one of his earliest kind of managers slash, I don't know if you'd call him a bodyguard, but, you know, someone who was there from the very beginning when he was R. Kelly in public announcement, who comes on camera. He was always a little older than R. Kelly, and was a witness to R. Kelly and Aaliyah's marriage, helped them forge the documents that allowed them to get married because she wasn't 18, as the law required. So we have people like that in this. We have both of his brothers. And, yeah, obviously. I mean, we have a legal obligation to reach out to R. Kelly, to invite him to be interviewed, and also to present his legal team with some of the stories that we got. So all of that was done, of course. And I wish that he had, you know, agreed to be interviewed. What he did do when it was announced in the spring, early summer, that this was happening and was going to be released, was he released this ridiculous 19-minute non-confession song called I Admit, where he takes absolutely no responsibility for what he's been accused of. But I see that as a very naked and now a very, very much understanding his patterns around his manipulative patterns. I see that as him trying to, you know, put forward a defense, a pre-defense.
Mm-hmm. It's been now more than a year since the Me Too movement started. It's been nearly a year since Time's Up started at the Golden Globe Awards this past January. How much progress do you think both movements have made toward either bringing this sexual misconduct, sexual harassment to light, and in terms of, more importantly, forwarding people toward not just enlightenment about the issue, but actually taking action to do something about it so that the workplace environment, the entertainment environment, is a far better one for everybody involved?
Well, I come from a tradition that's a little bit longer than the past year, you know, and acknowledge that tradition. And I don't mean to say that this moment that we're in isn't powerful and important, but this is an iterative, you know, movement. And it didn't start in the 70s even. But that said, I think that a lot has happened. You were talking to a guest earlier, and you briefly mentioned The Handmaid's Tale. You were talking about Hulu and what they may be, you know, doing next. And I worry about blowback also. I worry about, you know, what all of this could lead to. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't do the work and that we shouldn't stand up and that we shouldn't demand safety in the workplace and in our personal lives also, and also justice. But it also means that we are already seeing kind of, you know, and it starts out really benign. You know, you're at a conference or a public space or a social gathering, and all the dude bros are like, I don't know if I can hug you. Can I hug you? Am I going to kick case? To actual, you know, firms on Wall Street actually instructing bankers, traders to not have private meetings, et cetera, with women, which, of course, you know, makes it impossible for women to do their work. So I'm already seeing the blowback, and I know that other people have talked about this already. Jody Cancer, I think Rebecca Traister was talking about this, and so I'm keeping an eye on that also. But that doesn't mean that we don't do the work. That doesn't mean that we don't go forward. And when it comes to R. Kelly, trust me, the blowback was immediate. Sadly, from his female fans as much from the men. And any one of our survivors can tell you what kind of the kind of harassment and the kind of targeting that they've received. Obviously, you know about our screening. You know that that was interrupted because someone called in and said that there was a live shooter in the audience, and that if we continued our screening for our private screening for press and activists and advocates, that they would begin shooting. So it was all in the news that we ended up having to evacuate the place where we were having the screening. That is kind of what the girls have been facing, some version of that, since they began speaking out to places like BuzzFeed. So they have been disbelieved. They have been accused of all kinds of things just for telling their truth. Some of that is, you know, exacerbated by the fact that they're black girls. And some of it is just what it means and why women have historically not spoken out, because it's like a textbook. We know what's going to happen when we speak out. We will be harassed. I mean, I still think of, you know, the Kavanaugh hearings and you know, how Dr. Blasey Ford is still in hiding. For speaking out. It comes at great risk, actually. So, again, these women are heroes, these survivors.
I do want to let our audience know before we ask our guests one more question. In case you have noticed, you know, usually when we identify a guest, you know where they're coming from, what city. We're not doing that in this case. This was something that Dream requested, and we are honoring that request. But I did want to let you know that, if you were a little bit concerned, that's why. So just want to get that out. Dream, where do you think we stand in terms of television diversity? I think this has been a year where we've seen the exclusive deals with Shonda Rhimes, with Kenya Barris, more recently Shane Duguay, the former of ABC Entertainment, now involved with Netflix. The producer of Iron Fist just made a major deal with Amazon for original programming out of Seattle. Ava DuVernay has made a deal with Warner Brothers. We're seeing more women of color like Viola Davis, America Ferrari, Gina Rodriguez, formed production companies, now they're starting to get deals. Where do you see TV diversity going right now? And what's your next project in television? Where are you going to be going in 2019?
Yeah, well, I would suggest people who are actually interested in what's going on in terms of diversity in, say, television and particularly in writers' rooms to Google Color Change Writers' Room Report. I hear you on naming those people, and I'm excited about all the work that all of them are doing. But we're also we have data now. We don't have to just deal with anecdotal evidence. And, you know, we know that in the writer's room, there's like 4% in terms of black people. We also know that there are real outcomes to the ways that we continue to be represented on television. So there are all kinds of studies that have, you know, done deep dives. Color Change partnered with UCLA and a professor there, Darnell Hunt, who's been doing this work for decades, and really did a pretty comprehensive report on what's going on with television. In terms of myself, my next project, I executive produced It's a Hard Truth, Ain't It? With director Madeline Sackler. We shot it entirely in Indiana's Pendleton Prison, and that debuts on HBO February 27th. That is a documentary where the guys on camera who are inside, who are, you know, imprisoned, are the co-directors. It's a really unique documentary, and I'm excited for that to air on HBO February 27th. And after that, I'm executive producer on a project with Leaps and Bounds with David Leeson and with Dwayne Johnson, Seven Bucks. And we are doing a show on BET called Finding Justice, where we are looking at six different injustices and doing deep dives on them. So we ended up in Georgia on election night talking about voter suppression. And that's just one of the shows. So those are my next three projects, January, February, and March. Thank you for asking. But I'm really excited about, you know, January 3rd, 4th, and 5th. This is going to be a marathon night. I hope that, you know, survivors of sexual violence kind of, you know, watch it carefully, maybe watch it with friends. I can't promise you that this is going to be some feel-good three nights. It definitely ends on we try to end it on as upbeat note as possible. But it might be hard viewing, but necessary viewing.
Well, we're talking about Surviving R. Kelly. It's a three-night blockbuster miniseries on Lifetime, and it begins next Thursday, January 3rd, 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific. I should say the following Thursday, January 3rd and 4th and 5th, 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific time on all three nights. Check out before Lifetime is available in the area on cable and satellite. For more details about the promo online, www.mylifetime.com. www.mylifetime.com. Now, Surviving R. Kelly begins Thursday, January 3rd, 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time. Dream Hampton, the executive producer of the project, thank you again for joining us. Again, from all of us, all of you, have a wonderful holiday season. Good luck with your projects in television and other places coming up in 2019. We'd love to have you back anytime.
For sure. Merry Christmas and Happy Kwanzaa and Happy New Year. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Dream. Take care. All the way to see you.
Okay. Bye.
Dream is an executive producer of Surviving R. Kelly, joining us live right here on Tomorrow Televised. Coming up Wednesday on our program, don't forget we'll be with you next Wednesday and Friday. And coming up on Wednesday, we will have Sophia Nicole from Into the Dark, New Year, New You, co-writer and director of that latest production on Hulu. And also, David DiCato, the director of the new Lifetime Movie Network feature, The Wrong Teacher. If you came in late on today's program, want to catch up on episodes you missed, go to the homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Check out our podcast all Christmas weekend long on iTunes, Apple TV, Speakers app, as well as www.irradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. What's your thoughts on where TV is going in 2019? Let us know. SimonApple04@yahoo.com. Find me on Facebook. Follow me on Twitter. We hear you because what you say matters. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants. Not only those of Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, and IR Radio. Our production associate is ETR's Janice Williams. Andy Toews, Blog Talk Radio's general manager. Jim Sodberg, executive content producer. The co-founders of ETR are Alan Levy and Bob Cherish. Tomorrow's Televised was brought to you today by Audible.com and Amazon.com. Remember, Audible transformed the way you hear the world. For three free audiobooks, two Audible theater, and one regular book, go to audibletrial.com/televised. But Tomorrow's Televised, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you very much for your listening. All of us at Blog Talk Radio, Speaker and Honor Radio, wish you and yours a magnificent Christmas, Kwanzaa, holiday weekend. Please make it safe and great, and we'll hopefully hear you Wednesday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific. You know where. Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, and the Honor Radio Podcast Network. Until the next time, stay well and stay tuned.